Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane hopes to be back on the air next week. This spring, the Environmental Protection Agency announced its finding that greenhouse gases pose a threat to public health. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a climate change bill to address the issue, but the Senate says it won't have its version of legislation ready to debate before the end of the month. That has fueled concerns about the U.S. role in the World Conference on the Environment this December in Copenhagen. Joining me in the studio to talk about what's ahead is EPA Chief Lisa Jackson. Thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, Susan.
We will take your calls and questions later on. You can reach us with our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Now, we know the House passed the climate change bill, the Clean Energy and Security Act, in June. But we heard this week that the Senate version won't be ready to talk about until the end of September. And I wonder how concerned you are about whether this legislation is actually going to get through Congress this year.
Well, I'm not concerned yet. I think that the delay announced this week is understandable. It is a piece of legislation that's very complex. The sponsors cited, Ted Kennedy's recent passing and Senator Kerry's health issues. And I think it just means a little bit more time. Certainly it's something that I remain hopeful we see get through the Senate.
We've got this Copenhagen summit coming up in December. And the Obama administration and the leadership in the House and Senate said they wanted this bill passed before that took place. Is that still a realistic timetable?
Well, I think the president has said over and over that he wants to see congressional action in both houses so that as we walk as a nation into Copenhagen, that long-awaited, sitting down at the table, we have a strong platform that reflects both houses' opinions.
What if that doesn't take place? What if there is not a bill passed in both houses by Copenhagen? Will that raise some questions around the world about exactly what the U.S. role is going to be on this issue?
Well, I think we're all pretty hypersensitive, and that includes the international community. Every single action in Congress and outside by my agency and others is watched. It's sort of the climate watch. But I think that what we need to do is also keep our eye on what the president's position has been all along, which is that the discussions in Copenhagen, the climate discussions, are part of what has been his agenda on clean energy from the very beginning, and certainly one of the things that he ran on in terms of its ability to create jobs in this country.
Has one of the problems been, you mentioned the complexity of the legislation, and that's certainly a factor. Mm-hmm. There's also this other big issue, big domestic issue the White House is working on, which is health care. We heard yesterday that President Obama will deliver an address to a joint session of Congress next week. Has that had the effect, the health care debate, had the effect of slowing things down on the energy bill?
Well, I think that even the Senator Boxers and Kerry, in announcing that they were going to take a bit more time, acknowledged that they needed to focus on and were focused on health care and the important debates going on that are going to go on in the Senate when they come back next week. And so certainly the Senate rightfully is spending an awful lot of time looking at that issue. Clean energy is no less important, but I think rightfully they want to finish their work on health.
You think that's the right thing to do?
I think so. I think that all along we've understood that for something on the order of clean energy, but also health care, they probably needed to be looked at in sequence.
If the health care bill goes well or poorly, if it's big legislation passed or it encounters terrible trouble, does that have an impact, do you think, maybe a political impact on prospects for the energy bill?
Well, we've seen people try to politicize that debate in that way, to say what happens on health care is going to influence not just energy, but, the entire presidency. I think it's important to remember that the issues are in some ways intertwined. We don't often talk about the fact that EPA's job is protection of human health and the environment. We love them both. I certainly respect the need for our country to look, especially in these economic times, at health care and have the robust debate. And I'm looking forward to the president, now that he's decided to address Congress. I know that that's going to be a seminal moment.
I guess some people make the political argument that if he fails on health care, that he'll be politically damaged, and that will make it harder to get the energy bill through the Senate. Do you think that's true?
I am somewhat new to Washington level politics, but I think that what's interesting about the energy debate is that it also is a very populist issue. I was in Indiana just yesterday talking to the Blue Green Alliance. Then I went to a U.S. steel factory. Then I met with business and environmental leaders. And it's very interesting. There are people who are engaged day to day in their lives, their jobs, or concerned around the dinner table about this country's energy future, our dependence on foreign oil, our national security, climate in terms of its ability to sort of turn on its head all the assumptions we make about our country and what we do and who we are. And so I think that they are in some ways independent issues. And I really hope that politics aside, people will turn to the next issue and look at it for the importance that it has for the country.
You got a lot of headlines in April when you announced that the EPA had concluded that greenhouse gases endanger the public health and welfare. Now, this really opens the door to the EPA taking action it hasn't taken before on greenhouse gases. Tell us about that.
Yeah, back in April, 2 years, I always start by saying 2 years ago in April, in April 2007, the Supreme Court of our land ruled that EPA must make a determination one way or another as to whether greenhouse gases endanger public health and welfare. So 2 years after that, based on science that was done under the Bush administration, we put out a proposal to say, yes, indeed, EPA proposes to make that finding. The reason it gets attention, obviously, is that it is not a finding in a vacuum. It is an important scientific finding, but it triggers potential regulation of greenhouse gases under our Clean Air Act.
Could the EPA do what Congress is being asked to do? If Congress doesn't pass the energy bill, can you say, okay, just administratively, we're going to impose these rules?
Well, I think that's a legal question. I can answer maybe a slightly different question, which is EPA can do some important things to start to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions in our country. We would do it under existing authority. That means the Clean Air Act. That means no new legislation. And I firmly believe and have joined others, and the president has said all along, that new legislation is the best way to deal with climate change pollution.
So are there things that the EPA could not do? Tell us a little about what you envision the EPA could do if you need to regulate greenhouse gases.
Well, the first thing we can do is be reasonable and use a common sense stepwise approach. A lot of people in this country really don't on a daily basis interact with EPA regulation, but EPA regulation affects the public health of every single American. And for years, EPA under the Clean Air Act, under the Clean Water Act, has been regulating sources with great effect, whether it's reducing SO2 pollution, NOx pollution, removing lead pollution from our air, you name it, there's been progress made. And so we know that the Clean Air Act is a very strong tool that would allow us to start to ratchet down huge sources of pollution. And I've said all along that there's a way to do that, if it comes to that, where we can move stepwise, starting with really large sources and moving to address those first.
Well, we've heard quite dire warnings from groups like the Chamber of Commerce that the EPA could regulate warehouses or offices or a school or a church. Is that what you have in mind, or would you avoid doing those kind of steps?
Well, certainly we would look to avoid it. I've said on testimony that I believe there are ways to regulate greenhouse gases that don't bring in smaller sources, that don't start from the bottom. That wouldn't make common sense. We have absolutely no intention of regulating every school, every church. My favorite is Dunkin' Donuts. I'm a coffee drinker. But I have no doubt in my mind that there are opportunities available. And in fact, as was widely reported recently, EPA sent a rule over to the White House proposing to tailor the regulation of greenhouse gases if it comes to that.
Well, what about the concern that some have raised that these kind of regulations are going to hurt the economy, that you go about imposing new rules on a manufacturing plant or a big business, and this economy that's had so many struggles in the past year could be damaged?
Yeah, and I think that's the strongest argument for legislation that includes market-based incentives to move to clean energy, to renewables, to energy efficiency. You know, we like to talk about climate regulation, but the other side of that is how do you get your arms around climate? Well, you do renewable, you implement renewable energy. You know, you have solar, you have wind, you have energy efficiency, weatherization, really clamping down on the amount of energy we use as a society right now. And the best thing about legislation is that we can put all those things together, all those tools, along with regulation where it's needed, but we can start right away on a comprehensive sort of economy-wide solution. And it's why I believe to this minute that we need legislation.
We talked just a moment ago about the impact of the healthcare debate on environmental issues like energy, and I wonder what the effect of this economy has been. We're just now seem to be pulling out of the worst economy since the Great Depression. Has that affected your goals or your methods at EPA?
It's interesting. One of the things that has made the job really exciting going on is working for a president who said we do not have to choose between a clean environment and a growing and prosperous economy. And in fact, he's actually linked the two. He said we can find a path. One of the paths out of this recession is to build millions of new manufacturing jobs to replace the ones we've lost. And where will they be? They'd be in the clean energy sector. And I'm all smiles because if you build clean energy jobs and that means you're implementing a clean energy agenda, I know the air is going to get cleaner. I don't have to even guess. And so for us, it's and for me personally, it's just a really exciting time to be working for a president who puts those two issues together.
We're talking to Lisa Jackson. She's the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. We're going to take your calls. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio for this hour, Lisa Jackson, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. We'll take some of your calls and questions in just a moment. First, let me ask you, we're waiting for your agency to come out with auto emission standards. Tell us what those are likely to call for.
The good news for our country is that there'll be one set of coordinated standards. EPA standards, which under the Clean Air Act are really geared towards greenhouse gas pollution, and NHTSA, the Department of Transportation's CAFE standards, the miles per gallon number that we're all used to seeing on the side of cars when we go to the lot. Those standards will now be coordinated, along with standards that the states were putting forward under the leadership of the state of California. So those are calling for, as the president announced back in May, 35.5 miles per gallon fleet-wide average fuel efficiency by the year 2016. That's 4 years earlier than had previously been outlined for us to reach that milestone.
You know, we had gotten a question from someone about renewable electricity. You had mentioned renewable energy earlier. And during the campaign, Barack Obama often talked about establishing a national standard for renewable electricity that would require utilities to supply 25% of U.S. electricity from renewable energy sources. They say that they haven't heard that much about that lately. And I wonder, is that still the administration's goal?
Well, the standard that's in the Waxman-Markey legislation that passed the House is a bit lower than that. It also includes the opportunity to take credit for energy efficiency as part of renewable energy, sort of the idea that the best renewable energy is the energy you never use kind of argument, sort of a piece of folk wisdom. And there has been a bill that passed the Senate under Chairman Bingaman that has a renewable energy standard. Neither of them meet the goal from the campaign, but there are renewable energy standards being talked about.
What is the standard that they're talking
about? I believe
it's
15% by 2020.
Do you think that the 25% standard turned out to be a little too ambitious?
Well, I mean, I think the legislative process, there was lots of discussion from states who say, hey, I have a lot of wind, I don't have a lot of wind, I have a lot of solar, I don't have a lot of solar. And, of course, the discussions about what that means for states like Indiana, where I was yesterday, that have 90% of their power right now generated through coal and fossil fuels like it.
All right, let's take a caller. We'll take your questions, 1-800-433-8850. We'll go first to Kate. She's calling us from Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is about mountaintop removal coal mining. That recently, Dr. Margaret Palmer from the University of Maryland testified before the Senate on peer-reviewed scientific literature, a consensus that humans cannot recreate what headwater streams provide for us, both in the function of the water, the structure of the water and everything. My question is if we know that mountaintop removal and valley fill is so detrimental to our headwater streams, why is it allowed to continue?
All right, Kate, thanks for your call. I'll mention that we have gotten any number of emails also on the issue of mountaintop removal. I'm not sure everyone understands exactly what the question is here. Tell us about what the controversy is on this.
Sure, and thanks, Kate, for the question. Mountaintop removal is a practice in Appalachia. There are thin seams of coal, and companies have come to the practice of using explosives to literally blow off the tops of mountaintops. It's a surface mining and surface extraction technique. It levels the top. They take the seams of coal. That's the product they want. And then you have to do something with all that rock that's left. That rock has been, by practice and by regulation, allowed to be put into valley fills. And those valley fills are actually also the source of headwater streams. We all know water runs downhill. So at the top of those mountains are the headwaters for drinking water and for the streams that run through and rivers that run through Appalachia.
So we've had emailers and also Kate just on the air asking about your position on mountaintop removal. What do you think should be done about that?
Sure, I'm happy to answer. Let me first start by acknowledging that Kate's right. At the hearing, I was also proud of the fact that some of the science that's out there is by EPA scientists. I think we had Dr. Randy Pomponio at the same hearing or a similar hearing testifying about the work EPA has spearheaded, along with academics, looking at issues of conductivity and the effect of conductivity and suspended solids on aquatic creatures, sort of the indicator species that begin to show us whether or not there's stream degradation. And it is true that much of the science shows that when you have a lot of, when you start to see a preponderance of stream miles filled in, you start to see higher conductivity levels, which is indicative of higher suspended solids, which starts to affect the aquatic ecosystem, sort of from the bottom up. And so activists and people who live in the area have raised concerns about why this practice had been allowed to continue. That's because there were rules put forth under the Bush administration that allowed it was sort of a funny name. It was a stream buffer rule, but the buffer rule interpretation actually allowed no buffer between the stream and the fill. EPA has committed to reviewing projects. It's been a contentious issue from the start, certainly in Appalachia. We are in the process of reviewing about 84 permits right now that were put on hold by litigation. And in the next few weeks, we're going to have to make a determination under the Clean Water Act as to whether those permits can meet the Clean Water Act standards or whether they should be held up and potentially ultimately vetoed. EPA has the authority to veto the permits. The permits themselves are issued by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So EPA plays sort of an oversight role there.
Do you have a personal, I realize the EPA hasn't made a decision yet, but do you personally have a view on this?
Yeah, you know what? My personal views are absolutely irrelevant. I have a view that we should uphold science. The best science we can muster is why I'm proud of the fact that the science that's that's out there. EPA had a role in trying to understand, and that our job is actually narrowly defined. It is about protection of water quality. There's lots of other views about the practice itself, about whether or not it's good for the communities, whether or not it's good for the workers, but all we can and should look at is whether or not the practice comports with the Clean Water Act, whether it's scientifically valid, whether it's legal.
It sounds as though this has changed sort of the landscape, perhaps, of some of West Virginia. Have you seen what happens when they do this process?
No, I have not yet seen it with my own eyes. I've certainly seen lots and lots of pictures. It is like much of what we came to know as strip mining. It is not a process that's appealing to look at. What's also important is with any mining, I also visited Wyoming not too long ago and saw sort of the equivalent on in the Great Plains. And there, the seams of coal are much, much, much thicker. And the restoration is something that the state takes very seriously. And so one of the issues has also been, as Kate mentioned in her question, whether there's really any way to remake a mountaintop once you've changed the elevations like that.
All right. Kate, thanks very much for your call. You know, you mentioned your determination to put science before politics. There was a lot of criticism of the EPA during the Bush administration for putting politics ahead of science. How would you assess the record of the EPA during the Bush administration?
Well, I think that EPA scientists were there and working, that EPA is like any other large organization. We have about 17,000-plus employees, certainly not a monolith in terms of agreeing on even science. You know, science is environmental science is a body of work that continues to expand. The more we learn, you know, we've learned to detect contaminants down to very low levels. We've got more and more information over time on health effects. And so we owe the American people at EPA a couple of things. We owe them the assurance that we will always put the science and speak transparently about what the science says in front of them. We owe them the right to review the work we have, to follow the administrative process when we make rules or regulations, and to, as much as possible, not make our decisions based on politics, but on the law.
Do you think that got out of whack in the previous administration?
Well, I do believe that there were some pretty well-publicized incidents of science that wasn't allowed to come to the fore. I also think that we have any number of court cases where literally the courts, the highest courts in the land, ruled that EPA in some of its rulemaking just made no sense. I think everyone's favorite quote is the one that compares it to Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass. When a court speaks that way about a rulemaking in terms of its reliance on science, I think an agency has to regain the trust of the American people, and that's what we're trying to do.
Do you think that the trust of the American people and the credibility of the EPA was eroded?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think all the employees there feel the same way, and it's something that we take very seriously. I have spent the first, you know, 6-plus months really saying to the American people that EPA is on the job, that we're going to be back on the job, and most importantly, don't take my word for it. If there's information, we're going to put it out there as often as we can. We've had a couple of dust-ups where people say we want even more information. We're trying everything we know to turn the ship in the direction of transparency, in the direction of getting information out as soon as we can. Not long ago, we announced that we would put toxic release data out. I think it's about 5 months earlier than had ever been done. It's pretty much raw data. But the idea being that, listen, as we are doing our work, we will look to the American people to help us review that information, too.
Now, your own background, you started out not in politics, but as a scientist yourself. You're trained as a chemical engineer.
I am.
How did you get involved more in the policy side of things?
Yeah, it took a little bit of time. I was an engineer in undergraduate school at Tulane University. Have to give them a shout out since I'm here at MU. But right around the time of Love Canal and Superfund was coming to be a program. In 1980 is when the Superfund law passed. And I originally wanted to be a doctor. So I sort of had this public health idea. I was good in school. And I think over time, looking back, it was sort of the realization that engineers had been responsible for some of the technological advances that had literally remade our world. I'm a chemical engineer by training. And it occurred to me, and I firmly believe, that engineering is one of the most important solutions to the problem. It will be our solution on clean energy. It will be those kinds of technological breakthroughs that will propel us forward.
You worked in environmental protection for the state of New Jersey.
I did.
And for the current governor, Governor Corzine.
That's right.
So you're not totally new to politics when you came to Washington, but I wonder what has surprised you as you've spent the last 6 or 7 months here.
First, how hard folk work. We worked hard in New Jersey, but this administration has certainly hit the ground running. We've had and continue to have a really ambitious agenda because the president believes so strongly that it's key to turning our country around to the change he promised. And so we work awful hard. It's also been really interesting to remember that, like everywhere else, politics here is about relationships, and that what I've enjoyed the most is the relationships as we start to build them with members of Congress, even when we disagree, even with groups that we might disagree with. And by the same token, getting out, it's an extraordinary privilege to be able to get out into this country and talk to Americans about what they're concerned about when it comes to the environment. And Americans are very much concerned about clean air and clean water.
We've seen in Washington the Congress and the politics become increasingly partisan and increasingly polarized. And I wonder if that's been an issue as you try to deal with legislation, you try to get Republican votes, I'm sure, as well as Democratic ones.
Yeah, sure. You know, I try to remind people that another big change since way back when I was in college is that environmentalism was a bipartisan issue. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, these seminal pieces of legislation did not come without pretty much bipartisan, sometimes close to unanimous support. And so we've moved away from that. And I think as a country, it would be my hope that we think hard about that, because I can tell you, I get as many letters from Republican legislators, Republican mayors, as I do Democratic. The issue does not belong to either party. It really belongs in the hands of the American people. And at its most fundamental, we are parents. We are, you know, a community. And environmental issues tend to be driven because a community somewhere, a citizen somewhere, looks at something and says, I'm just not going to accept that. It's not right.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to John. He's calling us from Index, Washington. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm enjoying a nice downpour. We had a lightning storm after 2 months of no rain here. And I'm on the west side of the Cascades here, about 60 miles from Seattle. My concise point, I don't really have a question. I'd like to say God bless you for watching out for the meek organisms and people who can't speak for themselves and stuff. Health comes from clean water and all that stuff. The people commenting on environmental rules and regulation is one of the, other than voting, is about the most leverage we have with the government. And all you need to get standing on any action, I believe, is to know where it is and plan to even go there. You don't even have to have been to a particular piece of property or public land. You just have to plan. You want to go there and learn about the issue.
Okay. All right, John. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Stephanie. She's calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I just had a question about natural gas. It seems like, you know, over the last 5 or 10 years, I've heard a lot about these huge discoveries in Arkansas and Louisiana and Texas and Pennsylvania. But I don't hear a lot about natural gas really being used to generate electricity or kind of to be, you know, the bridge to the renewable resources. And I was just hoping for a comment on that and how the president feels about natural gas as part of the energy policy.
Okay, Stephanie, thanks.
Hi, Stephanie. Thanks. The discoveries, you're right. There have been some discoveries along with technology that have meant shale in parts of the country, Wyoming, down towards your neck of the woods and also out east, that has natural gas, it's always been there, we can finally get to. A lot of times this natural gas is more than a mile down. And so that as that exploration and development of natural gas continues, it is certainly a potential source of energy for our country. Just two things about natural gas. As a chemical engineer, I have to point out that methane, natural gas, is the feedstock for the vast majority of chemical manufacturing in this country. And so some people will say that while there is some need to use natural gas as a bridge, it's much less carbon intensive in its emissions than coal, for example. The long-term move towards natural gas would probably not be a great idea for our country because we're giving up its ability to be used as a feedstock for fertilizer, for chemicals, for a whole bunch of other industries that need it. Some people say that burning natural gas for fuel is like using your antique furniture, throwing your antique furniture into the fireplace to keep warm. So it's not that we don't want to use it, and it's not that the president hasn't said that we need to make sure we responsibly explore and develop our domestic resources. It's just that its use for fuel as a primary fuel is probably not a long-term strategy.
Well, I bet you see big regional differences in attitudes towards some of these energies, too. Stephanie's calling us from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm sure they have a lot of natural gas resources in that neck of the woods.
That's right. And I think what we're seeing, what's one of the interesting things about the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania and New York is that for the first time, natural gas resources may be available in much more densely populated areas.
We're talking to Lisa Jackson, the head of the EPA. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to your questions on the phone and by email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The U.S. Coast Guard responds to about 125 distress calls a day. More than 50,000 active duty and reserve members patrol our nation's oceans, coasts, Great Lakes, and rivers. A journalist takes us behind the scenes with the Coast Guard. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. I'm Susan Page with USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio, Lisa Jackson, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, the Washington Post had a story this week that said that environmentalists had been pretty slow to get going on this climate change bill. In contrast to some industry groups, they had some statistics in the story. It said in the first 6 months of this year, the oil and gas industry had spent $82.1 million lobbying Congress, and I think also airing ads, while environmentalists and clean energy groups had spent about $19 million, just a fraction of it, really. Is that affecting this debate, do you think, the amount of advertising and lobbying we see going on?
Oh, well, sure. I mean, advertising and lobbying are part of the Democratic system. I won't say whether it's a good or bad part, but they're certainly there. You know, again, in terms of money raised, I think the environmental movement has always been at a disadvantage against businesses. And in the case of oil and gas, you're talking about businesses that had record profits for many years over the price of oil skyrocketing. And so I think one of the keys here is, you know, how the American people feel and their memory of what happened to their lives when the price of gas shot up, you know, to $4 plus a gallon, what it suddenly meant. And I think one of the things that was interesting to watch was sort of the cash for clunker reaction. When Americans were given a little bit of incentive to try to help the economy out and also the environment at the same time, we saw folks superseding expectations in terms of what they bought. And I hope that that is part of the American people speaking back to big oil and saying, listen, we understand you have a business, but our country's security is really important, and those spikes in prices can really affect our economy as well.
You know, you mentioned the Cash for Clunkers program. You have a kind of version of that yourself with a program to help offset the cost of investing in renewable energy projects like wind farms and solar power, part of the stimulus package. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this program.
Well, that program is run out of the Department of Energy, and the stimulus package included well over, I think, $14 billion between loan guarantees and outright grants for weatherization and for technology development and deployment for renewable fuels. You know, the Recovery Act has been a great place for EPA as well. Most of our Recovery Act money is on water and wastewater infrastructure. And even there, Congress saw fit to set 20% aside for green infrastructure projects. The idea that water, which for most municipalities is the largest energy user, if you can run some of your water plant on solar or on renewable power, you can actually over time bring people's bills down.
All right, let's go to St. Louis and talk to Clay. Clay, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I just want to ask about funding, because it seems I live on a small lake community in St. Louis, and it seems years ago the EPA was very helpful in giving suggestions and encouraging us to remove silt out of our lake and try to reduce the silt coming in, and, you know, it was very helpful. But after they lost funding, now they come up with all kinds of fees and impact studies that need to be done before we can put the silt off property. And it seems like the fees have actually gotten in the way of actually getting anything done. And it seems like it's a funding issue that's the way the EPA gets most of their money now. So they actually become part of the problem instead of part of the solution. Could you respond to that?
All right. Thanks for your call, Steve.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Clay. I think that I certainly don't want to hear being part of the problem. Listen, I think what I hear in your question is that we share the same goal, which is an understanding that as we've gotten a handle on what the pollution that comes out of pipes, we haven't necessarily in this country been able to crack what we call runoff pollution, non-point source pollution, the pollution that enters our waterways every time it rains. And that comes either from developed areas, comes from our roads, our runoff from our roads. It can come from our sewer systems, many of which are old and overflow when it rains. It can come from agricultural lands when pesticides and fertilizers that are meant to stay on the land are washed off. And so we all have a real interest in trying to find ways to get our arms around that problem. And you're absolutely right. It's going to cost money. The Department of Agriculture and EPA are working together to try to find ways to make sure that non-point source money, money for agricultural conservation, are targeted to places where we can make real differences. EPA has Section 319 money under the Clean Water Act. That's probably the funding you're talking about. It's important to remember that under the Bush administration, EPA suffered the largest cuts of any agency in federal government. About 30% of our budget was cut. The president put forth the highest budget EPA has ever seen, about 28% higher. The vast majority of that money is going out in grants to states for water and wastewater projects. And so as we restart the engine of really putting investment into water and wastewater, I think yours is a great suggestion of ways that we can reengage the American people in clean water, which is something that clearly they care about.
Thanks very much, Clay. We've got a lot of emailers who are talking to us about greenhouse gas emissions. Here's one of them. Steve in Tacoma Park, Maryland, sends us an email. Does the EPA have the authority to establish an emissions cap and trade program under the existing Clean Air Act? And if Congress does not pass legislation, would you eventually use that authority? Now, if you choose to do so, could you?
Well, that's an open legal question. Thanks for the question, Steve. We always joke that there's lots of EPA employers in Tacoma Park. So if this is one of my employees, well done, Steve. But I don't really have an answer. One of the big issues has been whether or not the existing Clean Air Act could be used to do a market-based program like we use for sulfur dioxide acid rain in this country. The sulfur dioxide program, which started in 1990 and finally got up and running in the early 90s, has reduced sulfur dioxide emissions, I think 80% is the number, and done so while the economy grew. So we like market-based programs. That's what cap and trade is all about. But whether we can do that in the absence of legislation is an open question, and it's why legislation would be so much cleaner.
We actually have an international audience here on the Diane Rehm Show. Many people listen to it abroad using the web. We've got Elliot on the phone. He's calling us from Berlin, Germany. Elliot, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much. I have a number of questions, but the first one, I've been involved in trying to combat climate change for quite a few years now, back in my hometown in Hudson, New York, working on a renewable energy project to try and heat, cool, and power the city. But one question I always come back to in my research and so on is the relationship of population growth globally to climate change. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
All right, Elliot, thanks very much.
Yeah, I think my comment, Elliot, and thanks for the question, is that we have been able to see our economy grow, our energy usage grow in this country. And I have two sons, one's 14 and one's 13. And looking at the way they use electricity, I know that for us to continue to develop technologically, our energy intensity is probably going to go up. So we have to do a couple of things. We have to become a lot more miserly with energy. We need to make sure that appliances, that our homes, that our vehicles, that the places we work, the places we worship are energy efficient. That's just a matter of getting us as Americans to realize that energy is a very precious and expensive commodity. And so that means when you look at energy efficiency, there are certainly models that show that you can become energy efficient and still grow, and that includes population growth as well.
All right, let's go to Denver, North Carolina, and talk to John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I'd like to ask, Ms. Jack, are you familiar with Alan Carlin?
Alan Carlin is an employee at EPA, absolutely.
Yeah, he wrote a 98-page report that was very skeptical of CO2 and how it and its effect on global warming.
Mm-hmm. I'm aware of that.
Yeah, and that, well, I know you are, because the report was suppressed by the EPA. Mr. Carlin was told not to have any contact outside of the agency. And this was reported by CBS News in June. And it really goes to your comment about the trying to take the politics out of the EPA. I think what you've done in coming in there is just put different politics in the EPA.
All right, John, thank you for your call. Lisa Jackson.
Yeah, thanks, John. I'm happy to respond. You know, at the time that Dr. Carlin made clear that he felt his report hadn't gotten enough attention within the EPA, the first thing I said is he should feel free to put it out. On top of that, we've made sure he put it out on his own website. We have it. There was several work groups where Dr. Carlin was able to attend. He was actually on a work group. But I think, if there are any concerns lingering about his role and it sounds like there still are. I think the good news there is that Dr. Carlin's full report has now been entered into the public record. I think he did that back in July. That requires by law that each and every point in his report be responded to duly, along with the other comments. So the American people should feel comfortable that the process worked, that the idea of transparency in rulemaking is that comments come in and the agency is bound to respond to comments. That will happen here. Those comments that should be responded to will be duly responded to, just like the other over 300,000 comments that we received on the endangerment finding.
Do you think there is a scientific question that remains about the man's impact on climate change?
I am not a climate scientist. So what I do as head of the agency, there's any number of scientific decisions that we have to make. I believe in a couple of really important process points. The first is a strong reliance on peer-reviewed data, on scientific data that has undergone the rigor of peer review. Scientists have been using peer review as a tool to come to consensus for a long time. I know that major scientists from every major organization have come to the conclusion that not only is the climate changing, but that it's human and anthropogenic influences that are causing it, and that we are actually losing ground in that race. So, you know, what I want to be clear of there is that the endangerment finding, as we talked about earlier, is a regulatory finding which goes further even than whether or not the climate is changing and whether humans are causing it. And we owe the American people transparency as we review comments that come in from all sources, including any of EPA's employees.
We have an emailer from Newtonville, North New Jersey. Fred is writing us from New Jersey. He says, 10 states in the Northeast, including New Jersey, already have a regional cap-and-trade program. How's this working, and how will the national cap-and-trade program play into this existing program?
That's right. The New Jersey is a member of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, 10 states who've already had several cap-and-trade auctions for greenhouse gas reduction. And I think, you know, what the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative is called REGGI, R-G-G-I, so people call it REGGI, and I certainly worked on it when I was in the state of New Jersey, was trying to do was use the labs as that great, I mean, use states as those great laboratories of democracy that we hear so much about from our founding fathers, the idea that states can step forward and try things. And the states have, that are involved in REGGI, along with Western states who have their own Western governors, climate initiative, and some Midwestern states, have done some incredible work on energy efficiency and on making market-based incentives go, and they're certainly influencing the legislative debate.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got another email. We've gotten a couple emailers skeptical about, I think, the idea of green jobs. And here's one email we got. This person says, when you talk about our manufacturing sector building new manufacturing jobs in the clean energy sector, what does that mean? Can you give us some examples of what some of these jobs would be?
Sure, happy to. Thanks for the question. You know, there are 37 states over the 10-year period before 2007 saw clean energy job, that sector, grow faster than any other sector in their states. In Indiana, where I was yesterday, during that 10-year period, there were job losses overall, unfortunately, for the state in manufacturing, but there was an 18% rise in clean energy jobs. When I was at the U.S. Steel Factory and at one of the rallies, I was there with steel workers who were making bases for wind turbines. So the idea is that to the extent that we build a new industry, an industry around clean energy, and we have the opportunity to harness American innovation, you're talking about whether it's metals fabrication, whether it's R&D, whether it's technical and maintenance work to weatherize homes, all very, very important, all clean energy jobs. We have the opportunity. We're sort of at this crossroad. And if we take the clean energy path, we can replace all these manufacturing jobs that we've lost. And we've lost them already, as I heard yesterday in Indiana.
Last week, you had an article in the Huffington Post, and you referred to what you called the environmental movement's own inconvenient truth. What did you mean by that?
Well, I'm also very much of the mind that we need to make all Americans see themselves in the issues of clean energy and environmental protection. Back to my earlier point about the importance of the environmental movement being back in the hands of the people. That's how it got to be a movement in the first place. And so I was particularly in that blog, I was particularly reaching out to communities of color. Because I think because of the proud history of the environmental movement in sort of the conservation movement, there's an idea still out there that we still fight that environmentalism means big, wide open spaces. But environmentalism also means a city block, an apartment building, a school in an urban area. And as an African-American woman, I think that's an important message that I can carry.
We have an emailer from Charlotte, North Carolina, that says, this is completely unrelated and perhaps even inappropriate given the serious issues being raised, but I'm just as proud. I am just so proud as an African-American to see an African-American woman like Ms. Jackson in her current position. You are the first African-American to hold the job heading the EPA. Tell us how you first met Barack Obama.
I actually met then-Senator Obama. He hadn't declared his candidacy at a Senate EPW hearing. I think it was on chemical security, which was an issue that he really cared about. What impressed me was that at that hearing, he was there. He clearly had an interest and a knowledge of the issues, and he listened intently. And a funny anecdote, I don't even think he knows it, but he later came to New Jersey, and by some strange set of circumstances, I found myself backstage with him without any staff on either of our parts. And I walked up and I said, "You probably don't remember me, I'm Lisa Jackson." And he said, "I didn't remember your name, but I remember when you testified before my committee."
That's pretty cool. Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show to talk about the issues you're facing as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.